And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton via the FM dial on 93.3 and also the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we have a special guest today, and that is Osama Reshek, and he is a legal supervisor at the Human Rights Clinic in the Faculty of Law at Al-Quds University. Osama, thanks very much for coming with us today.
Well, thank you, too. You're welcome.
Okay, well, we had to catch you on a Saturday or on a Friday just as you're leaving the country, but we're glad that we were able to catch you now because you were giving a special talk recently, and that was Wednesday, the 10th of August, and that was at the University of Western Ontario. And we'll get into that talk in just a moment. Your talk was entitled The Right to Education for Palestinians in the Context of Other Human Rights. And it's an interesting topic. We're going to get into education in Palestine. But given your interesting job here as a legal supervisor at the Faculty of Law at Al-Quds, could you tell us what it is that you do at that university?
Yeah, actually, University of Western Ontario have been building a kind of relationship with Al-Quds University in Palestine for the last 2 years. And in the last December, we hosted Dr. Michael Link and Mr. Douglas, the head of the Community Legal Services Center at our university. And we were thinking for a long time in what can be done to emerge this partnership between the two law faculties. So one of the things that actually we have our Al-Quds Human Rights Clinic where I work, and we are still new. My clinic was established in 2006, and we are more concerned with the human rights issues, and we are thinking to expand it to cover other kinds and other areas of law, which Dr. Michael and Mr. Ferguson were very welcome to provide the support to this expansion for hosting me here for this time in order to explore and learn the system of the clinical education that the University of Western Ontario have, and also in other part as well the system of the free legal services provided to the public. Before me being in Western Ontario, I spent also a week in the neighborhood legal services in downtown, and this type of clinics was established in Ontario since the 1970s, and actually they you hear the country have a great history in providing free legal services to the people. There are more than 80 clinics that established in Ontario. And they do an excellent cooperation and cooperative work together as well as the way they are dealing with the clients. So I came to explore the way of how they are working, and in the community legal service where most of my time I spent, it was a very good opportunity to me actually to explore the way of the clinical education that is provided by the community legal service and other centers as the pro bono centers that also provide kind of legal information.
Now, you said that you're working on a partnership between the two universities.
Yeah.
Now, this must be an interesting time because this is your specialty. You have a lot of expertise in the area, and you get to tour Canadian universities, Canadian legal areas, faculties and clinics, and see how things are done here. Now, obviously, I guess things are much different in Palestine, unfortunately, perhaps more different than they should be, because you had a presentation, you had PowerPoint materials and so forth, looking at the unique conditions in Palestine, and under occupation, it's more difficult to get an education, to educate in law, to practice law, to hold regular university classes. And it's something that has a history behind it, struggles for decades, for generations. I think maybe beginning with some of the earlier uprisings and struggles in 1967, I think you outlined about three stages of struggle. And could you tell us about, I guess, how the stages work, the first stage beginning, I guess, in the late 60s?
You are right that we have a very difficult environment for providing pure education to the students. We can't. There is many difficulties that extend from the earlier days of establishing our universities until now. So, in respect of as you said, the three stages that I outlined in my talk, in the first stage that started from 1967. that before that time, actually, we had no higher education in Palestine, and Palestinians, only very few of them who were able to pursue their higher education. Mainly they were going to the neighboring countries to study at their universities, and mainly it was Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. So it was this crisis environment that promoting for establishing the first university, which was Birzeit University. It was established in 1972, and to provide courses in social science and other kinds of in education courses. And the point that due to the absence of a national government, there were the people and the Palestinian society were in need for different developing projects that the university found itself carrying this responsibility, that it's not only providing the opportunity to have education, but it's also have responsibility to provide projects that support and help in developing the Palestinian society. And this is the reason why it was targeted since its establishment.
Well, you say targeted. Now, in this case, I think what we're dealing with perhaps was closures. Was it hard just keeping the universities open at that time?
Yeah, actually, just in 1973, 1 year later after the establishment of Birzeit University, it was closed for a year by military order, and the founder of the university, Dr. Hanna Nasser, he was deported to Lebanon and stayed in exile for 19 years. One thing also that through that era, from 1973 to 1987, Birzeit and other universities were closed more than 15 times by military orders. In the argument that they are causing kind of escalation for the conflict. But actually, targeting the universities, it wasn't only by closing. In the first era between 1967 and 1987, there was other measures that practiced by the Israeli military authorities. The most important is the military order number 854, which actually gives the Israeli authorities the authority over and the control over student admissions and curriculums, teach, and as well firing and hiring of the faculty members. Following this military order, there were another measures that emerged by the occupation. One of it was the loyalty oath, and the loyalty oath was issued by the Israeli military authorities, requiring the foreign staff at the Palestinian University. And this foreign staff, actually, most of them were Palestinians, that they were denied their residence rights. So they hold foreign nationality. They were required, according to the loyalty oath, to sign rejecting any affiliation to the Palestinian Liberation Organization and any affiliation to any hostile organization against Israel. And this actually caused a massive, because most of the staff rejected to sign this oath, it caused a massive deportation for our faculty members. This is one of the things. The other thing that were also is important was the censorship. So all periodicals, all academic resources that is entering the West Bank and the West Bank universities need to be permitted by the Israeli military authorities. So, for example, in 1979, Birzeit University protested that after a year-long attempts for having a permission for subscription for 50 periodicals that issued in Arabic. These attempts resulted only in one permit for one subscription, while actually the 50 periodicals were available at the library of Hebrew University, the Israeli University in Jerusalem. So we can see that through the first 20 years, Israel were working in diminishing the educational development, and especially in the higher education program, and they were very free in this, because higher education is not considered as a humanitarian law, so there is a lack of observance over this right. However, in spite of all of these measures, actually at the end of of that era, at the end of 1980, we had six universities that established in Palestine with more than 22,000 students that they are having, they are taking courses in several kind of science, as well as they are providing many of social and community services.
It sounds like a problem that Palestinian universities are facing is obviously related to the larger problem of the occupation. If you're having difficulty publishing, if you're having difficulty in controlling curriculum, it's because you don't have established sovereignty over those universities.
Yeah, actually, of course, because one of the basic elements for colonialism is to maintain order through maintaining the development of the society and keep repressing them, and this what can be seen clearly through the implications of the military orders in the Palestinian universities. But what I was telling you, like Ariel Sharon, the ex-prime minister of the Israeli government, he once said that education, Palestinian education and propaganda is more dangerous to Israel than the nuclear weapons. And this declaration, actually, it had a lot of consequences and a lot of measures that it has been seen that the government is confirming, the Israeli government confirming what Ariel Sharon's perspective according to our education.
Well, why do they think it's so disruptive or destructive? Is it the same way as slavery or the civil rights movement in the United States, in which there was a great fear of educating slaves, educating African Americans, because you want to maintain an existing order?
Exactly, because you know that the education is the basic element for developing any society. There is no any society can be able to be full aware of their rights, their mission, their responsibilities in any place without having a good education that can provide them this knowledge. And Israel was aware to this point from the beginning. So that's why they were denying the Palestinian right to have their education. And we can see that in the second era, it was more clearly at the 1987, after the first Palestinian population uprising, which is known as Intifada, it launched in December 1987. So a few days following this intifada, Israel has closed the six universities in Palestine. And in the 5th February 1988, by a military order, the six universities in Palestine were closed. 2nd of February 1988, through the Israeli National Radio, announced that a military order issued to close the 1,194 schools. Following this closure by a few days, all kindergartens as well were closed. These military orders extended for 4 years and 6 months. The all educational process were crippled and were criminalized for more than 51 months. The students' gates, the university gates were closed. The students and teachers were not able to reach their universities, were not able to benefit from any of the facilities provided by the university, or to students were actually detained from the streets and caught from the streets when they were carrying books considered as they are going to illegal classes.
Now, illegal classes, how can you elaborate on that? How can the classes or education itself be illegal?
You know, after the closure of the universities, our staff and our Palestinian universities, we denied and we rejected actually the process of criminalizing the education, and we rejected to accept this criminalization. So the Palestinian universities start to teach in other places than the university, houses, churches, mosques, and private places for private people that volunteer to provide these places, underground and social clubs. And what happened that Israeli army start to follow these courses, start to follow our alternatives, actually, and they raided many classes, and teachers and students were detained. Until a time in the end of 1988, Jerusalem Post, an Israeli newspaper, reported that the Israeli army has uncovered a network of illegal classes provided by West Bank universities in schools in Jerusalem. A few days following this report, the Israeli army raided the YMCA in Ramallah, where most of Birzeit University offices were held, and they detained several of faculty's members, and they sent a warning to the administration of the Birzeit University saying that under no circumstances you can teach, and in any time we can see a sign of teaching, all teachers will be detained, and in any time we can see students even holding a book and walking in a street, they will be considered as approaching an illegal class.
Wait a minute. I mean, it sounds like education, Palestinian education, is being treated as a military threat, as a threat to the existence of the State of Israel. Now, how do they justify that? How can you say that all of this education, suspicious or whatever books, should be stopped?
If we want to talk about their justification since decades until now, and not only against education, against all other things, that all other violations against our rights were always justified by their security. So for them, for example, Hebron University were closed by a military order in 2003. And this military order was carried according to the army spokesman that, yes, we want to prevent the education that promoting for killing Israelis. I can't understand which kind of education that promotes for killing Israelis. Our university is very, very well known in the way they provide their education, how much it's subjective and a kind of freedom of exchanging opinions. And there was no signs that actually the Palestinian universities or that they promote for escalations. Somebody will come and tell me that it's understandable, but I can understand it if it come only to the universities. But to close 1,194 secondary schools, and all kindergartens, I can't understand what kindergartens can defeat the security of Israel.
Well, wait, are they still closed?
No, this closure is extended from December 1987 until 1992.
Okay, because I know that there are relatively calm periods, but even in these periods when the universities and schools are not closed, I know there's tremendous difficulties with the blockade and the siege.
Yes.
So how do you carry out day-to-day classroom activities? What difficulties do you have to surmount? How do you get around problems if you don't have access to the resources that you need?
Yeah, exactly. Now following the era of criminalizing the education, at 1992 and the starting of peace process, academics in Palestine were kind of optimistic that there will be a kind of improvement on the educational life that we are having in Palestine. However, what happened is completely the opposite. Israel started to attack our education system through different and creative ways. So people, they wake up, suddenly found themselves prevented from going and transport, going from city to a city or move from city to another city. Most of the Palestinians, they found themselves are not able to enter Jerusalem. People from Gaza found themselves that they are not able to go out of Gaza Strip. So there were a kind of a huge control over the movements of the Palestinians. So there are now, until now, from 1992 until the time that we are having now, there are more than 600 checkpoints that distributed over the area of West Bank.
Well, I mean, there's these obvious difficulties, checkpoints and occupations of areas, but if looking at the long term, at the overall situation since about 1967 or so, has there been progress? Has the idea of Palestinian education become more entrenched? Relative to 30 or 40 years ago, is it easier or more difficult for a Palestinian child to get an education?
Actually, I was meeting with many faculty members in this time from Aquash University, and we all actually say that if we are a student now, we can't make it. You know, we were students like 10, 15 years ago. It was maybe easier to us because when the university is closed, it is closed. All the students will not be able to have education. But now, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you found a checkpoint in front of your house, this is another kind of checkpoint that's called flyer checkpoints, which doesn't have a permanent place. They usually move it according to their interest, and it's usually made. Passed at the gates of the university. So when you found that in your term there is a checkpoint and you are not able to reach your university, and there is a class that is held, but you are not able to reach, this will make the education difficult to you, and it makes it individual. It makes the occupation more as individual responsibility. You know. So yeah, I think now for the Palestinian students, it's much difficult when we see that there are 95% of the Palestinian students who are enrolled at Al-Quds University have at least to pass one checkpoint every day. You know, in a survey that the Right to Education campaign, that for it's one of the projects that Al-Quds Human Rights Clinic run. There was a survey that we conducted last year at the fall of fall semester, and found that 80% of our students are not able to reach many of the university partner faculties. The Al-Quds University main campus is located in Abu Dis, which is one of the villages bordering to Jerusalem. However, now it's isolated from Jerusalem because of the wall, you know, and 80% of our students are not allowed or need a special permit to enter Jerusalem, where we have the social science school and the languages arts school, and so students are not able actually to continue the courses that they need. We can see this clearly also with the students of medical classes. The Al-Quds University is the only university in Palestine that provides medical studies. And this in cooperation with Al-Maqasid Hospital, which is located in East Jerusalem. So,
well, it sounds as if there's an obvious problem with access, in that there's checkpoints, borders, roving checkpoints. If you're a student trying to complete your post-secondary education, trying to get a law degree, what are you supposed to do exactly?
What he is supposed to do? What he is supposed to do, he has whether to consider himself that he is living in another country and to rent a house in the area surrounding the university, and or even in this case he will not be in safe because the village Abu Dis itself is facing a lot of collective punishment measures. Or he has to stay at his house and put himself in risk, and every time he passes a checkpoint, because through the 5 years, for example, the Al-Quds University witnessed 400 arrests for its students. There were 400 students that were arrested through the last 5 years, and a huge amount of those students were arrested at the checkpoints. So whether he will leave his home and his family and try to rent a house somewhere, and it can be logical to someone here, yes, that a student sometimes should live far from their family, but actually it's not far. Like 70% of our students who taught at Al-Quds University, they are from Hebron, which originally doesn't take more than half an hour by normal way. You know, but through the checkpoints, it, it, it needed many times more than 2 hours.
Yes,
or 3 hours.
Yes, a common experience for Palestinians. And I guess if you're a student in Palestine, it's hard to tell if you're a student or a criminal the way you're being treated. And you've mentioned problems with access through checkpoints and arrests that happen to students. I guess you feel like you're in a giant prison, and it's not made easier by the fact that there's a wall on the campus of your university at Al-Quds. Is it true? I get this from your presentation that the Israeli so-called security fence has put a large concrete wall now through your campus.
Yeah, exactly. The wall actually is another kind of the violations that committed against the Palestinian people in general, and the right to education in particular in that area. In 2003, the military order was issued to concrete an 8 meters high wall that actually annexed 63 dunums of the university land.
Well, how can you put a wall right through the university? Does some of it belong to Israel and some of it belong to Palestine?
No, the whole area where the wall is crossing is actually the area of West Bank, which was occupied in 1967. You know, Israel is not building the wall on the boundaries that internationally recognize. Israel is. That's why the International Court of Justice doesn't accept the name of the wall as a defense wall, you know, even as a separation wall. It's actually more as annexation wall, because what is happening that Israel is taking lands from the West Bank and annex it to the state of Israel.
Oh, is there a checkpoint in the wall there?
No.
There is no
checkpoint in the wall, which created an additional hour of transportation for more than 2,000 students who live in East Jerusalem, and now they, instead of going directly to the university, they need to circle around three villages.
Well, what if you're in one part of the university and you need to get to the other part that's on the other side of the wall?
What part?
Yeah, like let's say you're in the part that is the two-thirds of the university then.
Yeah.
How do you get to the other one-third?
Yeah, if you want to get to the other one-third, first you need a security permit that allow you to enter the state of Israel. And the second thing that you have to walk, to take a bus or to drive triple the distance that you need to take it actually in the, without the wall, you know. And the third thing that you have to pass as a Zaytouni or a Zayim checkpoint. You know, Al-Quds University itself is from south, east, and west is surrounded by five checkpoints that control all access to the university and to the village in general, you know.
No,
so, to get to the rest of the land of the university where is, for example, the playing field, if you saw in the PowerPoint how it was cutted and simply annexed to lands behind the wall, you know, you need, as I told you, more by 40 to 1 hour in time to
it sounds very it's very inconvenient. It seems to be placed there to make life difficult, to break morale. Are students giving up? Is it too difficult? Do people not want to pursue a legal education anymore?
Well, it's not. Students are not giving up. We are all, every year witnessing an increased number of students who enroll in the universities, and that's actually coming from our beliefs in the relevancy of the education as a need for developing our society, and for also to help us in upgrading and developing our resistance against the occupation.
Well, what about the United Nations? Are they doing anything about this particular issue? I know education, obviously this is something that is discussed at the United Nations within Palestine and what people's rights are. What about people's ability to access university services? Is this an international campaign now, or are you able to lobby or participate in United Nations discussions on this?
Yeah. Actually, that's the problem I'm telling you about, that the right to higher education is not a humanitarian. It's more cultural right. So this is what make a lack of observance over this right and a lack of activism for this right. And in wartime, usually, when human rights organizations start to talk about education, they talk about basic education more than higher education. However, there is now, and we hope that we could have a new shift, and that is through demonstrating humanitarian law itself in covering a long-term occupation, that the one that we have, you know.
Yes, I don't think international law was really meant to deal with an occupation of another country spanning many decades and dealing with generations of people that have to live and shop and work and undertake an education within an occupied territory, an occupied zone. This is something that you're trying to address in Canada and with legal scholars and at universities. So when you spoke at the University of Western Ontario and when you talked to us in Canada, what is it that you're looking for Canadians to do to help Palestinian students and help those who wish to take higher education within Palestine?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Actually, for me, for all of the time, I see that the first important thing is to let the people know. You know, since they know, they can then be able to approach their attitude to justice more than only having applied bias. So I would recommend all Canadians to read more about the Palestinian case and know more about it as much as they can, so they can really be able to evaluate how peace can be done and what the justified solution can be provided to those Palestinians who have been denied their rights for decades. And one of the things that I will really like to see that is the attitude toward the Palestinian case can be a priority in determining the policy of any institution or any center at the state, you know, so the people can take it in their consideration to see if this institution is working toward justice or not. So that's basically what I think. I think is needed not only from Canada, it's from all over the world, as well as to know more and to publish more in respect of the Palestinian case, so people can know and people can have, and we need to show the people the truth. And here people have the qualification to do that, and they have the abilities to do that. They have a good writing skills, they have a good analyzing, they have a good mind, so they can see the truth, you know, and they can describe it by the way that their neighbors, their colleagues, their friends can understand it. Maybe Palestinians have a problem that they are dealing by their feelings, but here it can be more subjective, and I think what we needed from the academic Canadians is to reflect the suffer of the Palestinians to the available communities, that they can do that within it.
Yes, people here can evaluate and analyze the facts from a distance, trying to get a broad overall perspective of things, and I'm glad you were here to do that. This is part of what your tour and what your lecture is doing, and it is raising awareness of this issue and helping Canadians be aware of the problems that post-secondary students face within Palestine in occupied areas, the entirety of it. So I'm sure that people at home at the university appreciate the work you're doing here, and groups like Independent Jewish Voices are glad to help in your tour and your raising of awareness. So, Assam, I guess I'd like to thank you very much. If we want to get more information about this, I know people can consult Independent Jewish Voices. Is there anywhere else you'd like to direct people to on the internet or anywhere else if they need to get more info on this topic?
You know, we have the Accountability Now campaign, and the website is www.justicenow.ps. And through that website, they can actually communicate with our center. And I would like also to thank you and thank your help to let people more know. You know, and I would like to thank all people who were with me in this time. In the 5 weeks that I spent in Canada, I have met a huge number of people with big smiles and with a lot of sympathy, and this was very encouraging to me. And I wish that one time we can give back these good feelings toward us. We can show our appreciation to it.
Well, yes, and that's what independent community broadcasting is for. It's so we can feature these stories that aren't always being picked up by the large corporate or government media here, but that are circulating at the community level and at lectures and at university talks. So once again, thanks. We appreciate your effort in that regard.
Thank you very much, Jeff.